You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Well, we'll get to our two special guests, Elizabeth Wynn and Heather Concannon, who are with the UU Community Cooperatives, which we're very excited to talk to them about. So you all have both been, are you both founding members of the Lucy Stone Cooperative? And so you want to start by describing that and then talk about how that grew into the UU Community Cooperatives? And then we want to celebrate with you your exciting news. So take it away.
Sure. So in 2010, we purchased the Lucy Stone Cooperative, which is a 11-bedroom, 5,000-square-foot, three-story big Victorian house in the Dudley Square neighborhood of Boston. And that is, so it's a cooperative living community where we share resources and food and community. It's an intentional community based on the values and tradition of Unitarian Universalism. And the Lucy Stone Cooperative is owned by the nonprofit Unitarian Universalist Community Cooperatives. So we started the nonprofit concurrently with starting the community, and the nonprofit kind of owns the house, does all the, pays the mortgage, holds the mortgage, does the, improvements, and is run by the members, which is part of what makes it cooperative. And UUCC, shorthand for Unitarian Universalist Community Cooperatives, just purchased our second house on October 15th, the Margaret Mosley Cooperative, which will be a 15-bedroom community about less than a mile from our first house, Lucy Stone Cooperative.
Yeah, and maybe I'll just jump in to say that these houses are coming from a strong yearning among many UUs to know what does it look like to live our faith every day of the week. What does it look like to raise children and grieve and do all the things that life calls us to do, and have the container of a home around that. And acknowledging the power, many of us who are involved grew up UU in UU congregations. So our congregational experience is sort of what has propelled us to explore this. And another piece is we often talk about how we want to serve people who aren't served by the dominant housing market. And that could be around money and the fact that we're able to keep rent more affordable than market rate housing because no individual landlord is making a profit off of the house. But also because there are people, whether they're elders or retirees or single professionals or single parents, who don't feel served by sort of the nuclear family housing model that we have in sort of our dominant culture.
Amen.
Or even people who might feel served but are alienated by the ways that our society breeds disconnection.
Yeah. How'd you get the down payment for that both of those big houses?
That's an awesome question. So we have a mortgage with the Cooperative Fund of New England, which is a fund that loans exclusively to cooperatives. And the rest of the down payment was made up of small loans. We've called them allied loans that are smaller investments between $2,500 and $50,000. And they're shorter term and lower interest than our mortgage. So we do 5-year terms at 3% interest. And we have currently, I think, $340,000 in small investments, these allied lenders, between our two houses. So a significant amount of the money was made up from these loans, and then a small portion of donations. But people can invest their money and get it back, and in the meantime, we use it to finance the cooperatives.
Yeah, and we were really excited about finding a way to be community-based in our financing and a way to, because we know that how we spend our money tells us a lot about our values. And it's really exciting that we're sort of in this larger conversation about divestment and values-based investing that's happening in a lot of places and the funding of cooperatives, which there's a lot of energy around right now.
Now, I saw on Facebook you have an investment club or something. Is that separate?
That is a separate thing. Boston has an investment club that actually many people who live at Lucy Stone are also involved in, and it's an investment club that invests in cooperatively owned businesses and organizations, and five of the people in the investment club live at Lucy Stone. So,
and they did make an investment in UCC. But I think, to me, it speaks to this, like, really amazing work that UUs are already doing and I think could do even more deeply about what are our spiritual journeys around money and for folks who do have the treasure to make investments, how can we not have that be like a thing that happens out here totally separate from our spiritual and religious selves, mm-hmm. but another aspect of how we live our values in our world?
One of the things that we realized also is that, you know, there's a group of people who are excited, who will be excited about living in a community cooperative or living with in one of our houses. And there's a group of people who are excited about coming over for dinner, and there's another group of people who are excited about it happening and want to be really supportive of it and have resources but, you know, aren't going to move across the country or aren't going to move in with 12 people but feel like there's a way to live their values with their money and to further the mission of Unitarian Universalism with their investments. That we are able to offer that opportunity, and we see that as a ministry for people to be able to align their values and their investments.
So what's day-to-day life like in a UU cooperative? What's it like to live there? How are you UU when you wake up in the morning?
That is exactly the question we're trying to figure out. We have youth groups come over for dinner and singing. We have dinner, a potluck dinner and Sunday night singing every Sunday night, and we turn the dining room into a little sanctuary for an hour. And we often have youth groups come through and we ask them that same question of what does it mean to live your values 7 days a week? What does it mean? How do you know you're a Unitarian Universalist when you're not at church? For me, and I think different people who live at the house would answer this differently, for me it has to do with how do we work through conflict? How do we make decisions collectively when, especially when we feel disappointed or disagreement? How do we buy food and cook food in a way that is aligned with our values? How do we engage in the wider systems? I think one of the things that feels important to me about living in community doing this work is that I could live on my own and try to buy more ethical food, or I talk all the time about how I have this grand aspiration to garden, but actually no skill or passion around it. And I, because we share chores in our house, I am able to benefit from the homegrown food that other housemates do as part of their shared work for the house, and I allow them to do that because I take on other chores in the house. I might cook dinners or so there's sort of a, as a community, we're more able to live more aligned with our values.
And I think, so I'll confess, I do not live at Lucy Stone. I am a proud recipient of generous hospitality in that I'm there a lot and come to singing whenever I'm in town and go to a lot of meetings there.
And serves on our board.
And serve on the board. But one of the pieces that I see playing out time and time again is that when you're living with people, it is much harder to walk away. And in our congregations, I think it can be all too easy to walk away when things get hard or when we're really called into covenant to really live our promises to each other. Or inevitably when there are values in tension and really good values, like the value of affordability of food is often in tension with wanting to buy organic food, which is good for our planet and for our bodies and for the workers growing the food. And instead of saying, well, I guess I'm just not going to be part of this conversation, or I guess I'm going to go to a different church next week, there is a level of practice that has to happen, because you're going to see that person when you're pouring your cereal or drinking your coffee or after a long day at work at like 10 p.m. eating snacks in the kitchen. And so I think there's some real important stuff that is being practiced and not just theologized about or prayed about or preached about.
So do you use modified consensus, or how do you make those difficult decisions?
We do use modified consensus. Yep.
And lots of singing.
What's that?
And lots of singing.
Sorry, Tom, what's that?
Yeah, what's modified consensus?
You mean a lot of things, so I'll let them describe it at Lucy's Tom.
Yeah, when the housemates are making decisions, so we've got the housemates, and the housemates have meetings every other week to talk about living together, and the board has meetings to talk, you know, depending on how much our workload is, to talk about the direction of the organization, and both use a modified consensus. But when we're in house meeting, we tend to not move forward until we have consensus and full agreement, though that doesn't always happen. And my experience of it is that it kind of lays out a process of looking at what the, like a shared practice around looking at what one's own individual preferences are and what one's own principles and values intention are, and kind of teasing those apart as a group and saying, okay, how much do we value personal preference? How much do we value values-based decisions? And how do we stay at the table and more deeply understand rather than, you know, and modify our proposals and our thoughts about where we're going together so that it works for different people.
You know, there's a topic it's rare that you find a topic that is as intense as food. How do you possibly make that work with 11 folks, you know, week in, week out? That just seems...
For me, it's a practice of living in ambiguity, actually, that we, I think, are never going to, there's always going to be some questions or it's never going to be a perfect system. We're never going to live in an ideal world where everyone agrees with 100% everything that we buy. So there's a question of, yeah, we've worked out different things, and a lot of it is actually really relational. I think that's what we've come to, rather than a policy about food, kind of understanding what people's preferences are. They know if I'm going to be home for dinner that night, maybe I don't want a spicy food.
But if you're going to live there, then you have to kind of agree that you're not going to eat a lot of meat, or red meat.
So we do, we purchase food that together that's vegetarian. We do allow people to have meat in the house, which for some people has... been a deal breaker, and they've not chosen to live at the house. Yep.
And I think it's also amazing to see how that intersects with hospitality, that there's an annual barbecue at Lucy Stone on the anniversary of Lucy Stone's birthday, and there's always been meat at that barbecue just in recognition of the fact that if people come to a barbecue in the summer, a lot of them want a delicious hot dog, including me, and or a delicious hamburger. And so there's always also vegetarian things, but that it's I guess the key for me is that it's not about perfection or like rigid allegiance to an ideal, but it's about, like Heather said, living with the ambiguity, which I'm remembering Heather and I and Meg and others are part of a entrepreneurial program of our UUA and UU Ministers Association, and one of the traits of entrepreneurship that we were talking about is the ability to live with ambiguity, that like, who knows whether this is right or wrong, but this is the situation we're in, and how do we love each other in that situation instead of turning our dislike of ambiguity into dislike of each other.
Go ahead, Aisha.
Well, I wanted to ask about the names, Lucy Stone and Martha Mosley, if you guys can speak to how you chose them for the names of the houses themselves.
They're both badass Unitarian Universalist women. Well, Lucy Stone was a Unitarian, and Margaret Mosley was, I believe, a Unitarian before the merger, and then a Unitarian Universalist.
Who is Margaret Mosley? I don't know who she is.
So Margaret Mosley was a Unitarian in Boston, and then after merger, a Unitarian Universalist. And she's one of those people, I didn't personally know her. She died in the late 90s, I believe.
1997.
But was one of those people who did justice work in every aspect of her life. Wherever she was part of starting either an NAACP chapter, she was Black, a civil rights person, an ACLU chapter, and was sort of someone who just supported justice work in her congregations and in every realm that she was in. And she wrote an amazing memoir called Moving Mountains One Stone at a Time. And I can't think of a more apt way to describe her approach to justice work. She also did a lot of peace work with the, someone help me get the name right, the Women's International League for Peace and Justice.
Peace and freedom.
Thank you. Especially when she was on the Cape, where she was in the later chapter of her life.
Huh, I wonder how I never heard of her. That's great. I love it when folks like that are lifted up. Tom, did you know her?
No, I didn't know her, but I appreciate when people look to 20th century Unitarian Universalists as historical inspiration, because we're so... 19th century oriented, that people, that you just don't get this kind of picture of what people who are more closer to our living situation, what they did with their lives and how they built the faith.
And I should just say, she also started a consumer co-op in Boston.
Okay.
So we were like, okay, a UU awesome woman who did racial justice work, feminist work, peace work, and did cooperative stuff, like...
There she is.
What an amazing ancestor to have in living this faith.
Yes.
Totally cool. So what sparked the second house? So Lucy Stone sounds like it's a great adventure in progress. So what made you say, let's do it again?
In June of 2012, we did a strategic planning day with all of our membership and our board and a bunch of stakeholders and community members. And part of this came out of that experience of strategic planning and realizing that part of our mission was calling us to not only have this one house, but to grow community cooperatives. We also rewrote our mission statement that day, or coming out of that day. The other thing that really, I think, compelled that even behind that was that in the, I think, 6 openings that we had most recently at Lucy Stone, 80 people have applied, really showing us that there's a market for this kind of cooperative, faith-based, intentional living community, and people who were amazing and who would totally benefit from living in community and who would totally bring incredible gifts to community. And we had one space available, right? So, which is at each of those moments, unlike a congregation, I think we have a cap on how many people can live in the house reasonably, and finding ourselves wanting to be able to provide this housing and this kind of community for the people who want it, knowing that there's a market and a need and a real hunger for communities of love and justice and intentionality.
Yeah.
Will they move to be part of the new start, or will that not happen?
Say that again?
Will part of the Lucy Stone Collective move to Margaret Moseley to start that and get the culture going, or will it just be a whole new batch of people over there?
So we've been working with... Go ahead, Elizabeth.
The way that we think of ourselves growing is that UCC has 3 core values of spiritual practice, sustainability, and social change. And we ask that all houses figure out what shared practices they're going to use to live those values. And we realized that Lucy Stone does those practices in a very particular way, and that may not be the best fit for everyone. Like, there are people who want to meditate in mindful silence for an hour every day, maybe, with their housemates, and other people who want to be doing affordable housing organizing, So Lucy Stone's spiritual practices include an hour of singing every Sunday evening. And there have also been different practice groups that sort of come together, particularly around meditation. And there's a lot of other things. We've done solidarity suppers where we pass the hat for a partner organization. We also have a practice of, depending on our capacity, having people who need a place to stay in the guest room, including partnering with the UU Urban Ministry around that. But I think just to think about Margaret Moseley for a moment, one of the things that happened is we realized that the core team for the Margaret Moseley House was really energized around this question of raising children in community and parenting in a spiritually grounded, community-centered way. And so that core group of folks, one of whom happens to be a resident at Lucy Stone, those are the folks who will be living in Margaret Moseley and sort of doing the cultural transmission. But I think the thing that's really exciting about expansion is not only do we believe that everyone who yearns for this kind of community should have it, like we're not in the business of creating exclusive cliques, like you have to be special to live in this kind of place. But we also realize that people want to live these values in different ways. And so some people want to live in a house that's really focused on families and children. And other people might want to live in a house that's more contemplative. And we can create as many communities as we need so that people can go deep in their faith.
Is everyone who lives there a UU in the houses?
Nope. People are Quaker and of no faith and Jewish and Catholic and Christian and not sure and a chunk of folks are Unitarian Universalist. And that's one of the sort of ongoing adventures we get to live with is what does it mean to be a community that's grounded in the values and tradition of Unitarian Universalism that is supported by so many Unitarian Universalist individuals and congregations and is clear in our UU identity and also is open to people of many faiths and no faith.
We often say that like congregations, we don't ask people to say they're Unitarian Universalists when they come to our congregations. We ask them to walk in covenant with one another and with shared values. And I think Lucy Stone is and UUCC is much like that. I also sometimes make the analogy, I went to Andover Newton Theological School for seminary, which is a Christian seminary. And I knew going in that it was a Christian institution and that Christianity was embedded in the institutional practices and was this incredibly important source and identity for the institution, and they were also incredibly welcoming to Unitarian Universalists, and there's a diversity of religious identities at Andover Newton.
How much does it cost to live at one of your co-ops, and what are the other expectations or obligations that residents have?
Mm-hmm. So our current rent is at the Lucy Stone Cooperative is $505 a month. That's about to go up with the new year. We tend to raise rent at a rate lower than inflation because we are able to keep our costs lower than inflation. Partially because we hold our own mortgage. And what are the other expectations?
When you say rent, does that include food and utilities, or is that just so then, does everybody chip in the same amount for food as well? What's it cost totally to live there?
Yeah, the houses do their own food practices, so we decide together how warm to keep the house, which internet to get, you know, kind of share the utility costs that housemates and roommates would share, and then decide together which food we're going to buy and how we're going to split that up. So I think food and utilities all together has averaged around $200 a month, which is, I think, yeah.
It's cool. Very similar to a family in a lot of ways. Like the monthly rent is set, but then the group can decide a little bit if they want to do something like around sliding scale or an emergency rent fund, which Lucy Stone has both of those, and then also decide, like, yeah, do we want to regularly buy fair trade dark chocolate and enough so that we can each eat a bar a day and have real maple syrup on our waffles every morning. We can do that and pay more, or we can have a bar of chocolate once a week and pay less.
So how close are you to being in a position where you think you could really replicate this or scale it up across the country? How big do you think, you know, in terms of like, setting up, you know, I could see this being, you know, in many places. I could imagine one here in Ann Arbor, or certainly in Minneapolis, you know, or Seattle.
Ann Arbor could imagine co-ops there too. The National Co-op Conference just happened in Ann Arbor last week.
Oh, I missed that. So, where do you see yourself in terms of that growth?
I think different people have different opinions on this one because it involves our capacity. But for me, the question is, how do we want to grow? Do we want to be the ones who own houses all across the nation and on half a dozen or a dozen college campuses? Or do we want to...
UUCC.
Being UUCC. Or do we want to figure out a way to do leadership development and technical assistance and financing that support others to scale but allow us to focus our resources sort of on teams of people who are planting houses? Mm-hmm. Or do we want to really focus on the conversation around shifting investments in alignment with our values and sort of champion that work and in doing so free up capital for projects like this and others? And I think the how is really exciting, and we're still figuring out how do we decide that. We know that this model is financially sustainable and is contributing to some real spiritual flourishing and some economic justice work in terms of investments, living values. But we kind of get to figure out and play with how might we want to grow. And I think another key piece for us has been that we don't believe in growth for growth's sake. I feel like that's a harsh lesson of our current capitalist economic system that we learn again and again. And so we want to keep checking back in and saying, you know, is this about spirit or is this about ego? Is this about the yearning for these communities or is it about like the fact that growth is exciting? And I think we're doing a really faithful job with that balance and we want to keep doing that.
That is really exciting. So you recently were one of six finalists in the Forbes $1 million Change the World competition, and you won $100,000 from the Forbes Under 30 contest. What was the vision that you put forward that made them give you that gigantic check that we've seen? We'll put a picture on Facebook of you guys holding that gigantic check. But
it was gigantic.
It was. Tell me about that day, and what did you pitch? Which of the visions Elizabeth just laid out? What are you doing there? What are you doing with Forbes?
We laid them all out. We laid them all out for them. So Forbes had this competition that came across our radar for social entrepreneurs under 30. And we sort of looked at it and we were like, I think we should apply. So we did. They were looking for, their framing was disruptive and scalable ideas. And we were like, well, we're scaling now, so I think that might work, and we can be disruptive, so let's be disruptive. So we applied, and they were also looking for faith entrepreneurs, people inspired by their faith as well. So we went down to Philadelphia for the Under 30 Summit in October, and all six of the finalists gave a presentation. And they chose one finalist as sort of the grand prize winner, and everyone else all got $100,000. And Elizabeth, do you want to talk a little bit about what we pitched?
Yeah. I mean, I think we felt like, okay, we've already won just by being finalists, and we really felt like it was a win for cooperatives, for Unitarian Universalism, for values-based investing. Even more so than a win for UCC or us as individuals. And we felt like the gift was being able to tell our truths and share our story with a community that at least I have never had relationship or access to before, a community that's primarily focused around entrepreneurship and also on starting new for-profit businesses. And we said what we thought is real, which is that no app can heal our hearts or save us from loneliness, that it is communities of real and deep interdependence that are doing that work, and that technology can be a helpful tool, social media can amplify amazing work, and can create community, but that there are ways that we need to be coming together in to share food, to sing together, to provide housing to each other, that are really necessary. And people were really responsive to that. We had people say, you know, yeah, I'm in software programming and it's amazing and I'm trying to harness it for the good of the world, and it's only going so far.
Now, I don't think of Forbes and disruptive as words that go together. What do they want to disrupt?
That's a great question. My sense is that they have realized that they've carved out this 30 under 30 framework, which I think has really helped them maintain their brand among younger folks. And I think they're responding to the fact that people are really energized around this framing of disruption. But it is, I think it's all relative. I think, you know, a disruptive dating app is maybe not like the thing I'm most excited about disrupting in terms of.
I had the sense while we were there that what we were hoping to disrupt was not necessarily what they were hoping to disrupt, but.
I personally would love to disrupt dating, so don't hold back. I do love the idea of like you guys going to Forbes and saying, yeah, we want to overturn the capitalist paradigm here. So,
which is exactly what we said. and you know, it's a really.
Who were their judges? Were they people we would recognize, or was it just
a bunch? I don't know. One of them went to a UU summer camp, though.
Yeah. They were a couple, all folks who had significant roles either in philanthropy or in business.
Mm-hmm. Well, they use the word disrupt in a very different way than we use. They think Uber disrupts.
Black Lives Matter.
Right. But I think, you know, I was amazed at the fact that people were so responsive.
Mm-hmm.
And even I guess it was powerful for me to sit at a table with people who I feel like I have very little in common with, like 21-year-old venture capitalists and people. Private equity people. And realize that we have a lot of common ground in some ways. And I know that we also have venture capitalists and private equity people within Unitarian Universalism, who some of whom have been amazing supporters of our work. So I shouldn't need to relearn that lesson again, but it was still striking that the sort of yearning for ancient practices and spiritual nourishment really is everywhere. And there is some realization that our current economic structures are not going to get us there.
It was also one story that that I kind of think exemplifies the wide diversity of life experiences that were there was that Elizabeth and I both wore clergy collars on stage and said we were ministers, and when we got off stage and were sort of talking to people afterwards, one woman came up to us and asked, are you really ministers? And we were like, yep. It's true. And she said, which I was surprised to hear, she's like, I've never seen women ministers before, which I thought was just really, you know, I grew up with women ministers. I grew up in Unitarian Universalism, where more than half of our ministers are women. And was just so, it was a moment where I realized kind of what a small slice of the world I can tend to exist in, and how cross-sector and cross-cultural in some interesting and surprising ways this experience was.
Did you make connections there that you feel like you can build on from having gone to that, or was it kind of like a one-shot deal?
I think time will tell.
We've definitely made some neat connections, and I think for me one of the big gifts of it was the invitation to dream really big and be really ambitious in our thinking, because that's sort of what they asked, like, cast a wide vision and tell us what it is. And so that's the piece that I'm excited to go to continue on the journey with, and to think together about how Unitarian Universalist individuals and institutions who are excited about this work can partner with us, how we can share resources, and how we can grow this model that is financially sustainable and is really spiritually nourishing.
Hey, put CLF in there as a collaborator. I think this is a really, really exciting movement for us spiritually. I mean, it takes home church to a new level, you know. It's not just people meeting. I mean, I think back on, I mean, you know, I owned a house cooperatively back in the 80s with other people, and it's certainly the foundation of my spiritual life, though it was not in any way a UU house. But those practices you talk about are very, very real. And what we didn't do well was leadership training so that when people started to leave, it fell apart. We did not pass it along well, which I know you are, so I think that's so important. But
it's really hard to do well, and we see that with many of our emerging ministries.
Go ahead.
I think it's something that we're also trying to figure out how to do best. I think it continues to be a question for us about how to transmit institutional history and institutional memory and create practices that are more based on the institutions and policies that other people can enter into than on the individuals.
Would you say you draw more from Fruitlands or from Hopedale in terms of your...
Well, unlike Fruitlands, we have warm clothes, and unlike Hopedale, we have fire insurance. So
that's a total UU insider joke. So
we'll talk about those other earlier collective experiences, and I wonder what kind of like orientation or training, for lack of a better word, do people go through as they come in or before they come to figure out if it's a good fit, or how does the history and the tradition get held up, you know?
Well, when people apply, they do a written application and then an interview, and we ask them to come to an open house to kind of understand the community, get a sense of very surface level kind of what we're about. And it's a good moment for them to realize that if the room is tiny or if they look at the kitchen and they realize they could never share a kitchen with 13 people, they kind of self-select at that point. And then we do an interview, which is kind of a mutual discernment interview. They get to learn a little bit more about us and ask their questions, and we get to ask questions about... we've really refined that process to ask ourselves what the core criteria is that we're looking for in new housemates. And then when they come, they get a mentor. You know, each house may do it differently is the other piece of this. So I'm just speaking from Lucy Stone's almost 5 years of practice at this point. 5 years in February we'll have been living in the house together, which is amazing to kind of realize. And so they get a little orientation. We have a housemate handbook, which has kind of all of those policies. And then part of it for me, as somebody who's lived in the house for a long time, is realizing that new people need to be acclimated to the system kind of consistently. And all of our conversation about not leaving sponges in the sinks may need to be repeated kind of on a regular basis, just because the turnover
That is
happens.
So true, though, sponges in the sink, man. I'm kidding. There are some universals in life, right? It all comes down to sponges in the sink.
And
so
I think
we have a couple more minutes. I'd love for you to say anything we didn't ask that you were hoping we would. And Elizabeth, whatever you were about to say, too.
I was just going to say, in terms of our spiritual ancestors, I think it's important to lift up that cooperative living in many different forms is ancient, and we inherit a lot of hard-earned wisdom from the cooperative movement in the U.S. and globally, and in addition to from sort of our liberal religious ancestors who were doing these communitarian experiments in the U.S. And so we're it feels like a miracle in a lot of ways that this is working really well, because it is so challenging, and there are so many communities that have done vibrant ministry and then dissolved. And so it's just really a blessing to be able to be part of this particular moment in this one.
Mm-hmm. And I want to lift up just sort of the gratitude that we hold for people who have supported us and invested in us and offered us advice and wisdom and feedback throughout the last 6 or 7 years as we've been starting up and taking off and now expanding. I think it's the the people who have been willing to offer time and support and energy, as well as trust and risk. I think that's an important piece of emerging ministries is how much risk can we tolerate and how much ambiguity can we tolerate as we're trying new things and exploring new avenues of what it means to live our faith. So I just want to really lift up all of those people who have been there along the way and on the journey with us.
Amen to that. And that makes me just one more really quick question. Where was this born? I'm picturing a young adult conference or something. Am I off? Like who hatched this this idea as it began at the very nucleus?
The story, as I understand it, is that it was born on the front porch of Greg Buckland's college co-op. Greg Buckland and Matt Meyer were our two UU young adults who collaborated and were involved in co-ops in college, and I think saw a compatibility among cooperative living and Unitarian Universalist values. From there, in 2008, they pulled together. 2009, they pulled together a planning team. Elizabeth and I were both on that planning team.
So don't you love that? From a front porch to two big houses and...
Two front porches now.
Yeah, two front porch. Well, exactly. And disrupting Forbes's world and $100,000. And it's really, really exciting and inspiring. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you for having us.
Have a last word to throw in here?
I want to talk to you guys later about starting a UU monastery.
Awesome. Let's do it. Onwards.
Right. That's an idea that's been around.
Thank you so much for having us. It's been great.
Absolutely. It's been really fun. Next week we'll have Bart Frost talking about UU youth programs. And great to spend an hour with you. Hope that you're finding the podcast. Let us know. Take care, everyone.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.